what is a Jew? Is a Jew different? Why is a Jew different? Now, a Jew is different already from a very early time, but Hashem made it very clear when he gave the Torah, he made it very clear, and he said that you are to be a holy people, an Am Kodosh, and a Mamleches Kohanim, and a kingdom of priests. That is what the Am Yisrael is to be. Now, what the Am Yisrael is in relationship to the other nations of the world, the Derech Hashem discusses that. That is much later. But I'm concerned, what is the essence of a Jew? So we see that in the Torah it says that a Jew is an Am Kodosh, is a holy nation, and a Mamleches Kohanim, and a kingdom of priests. If that is what a Jew is, then we are expected to live up to that. But now, what we spoke about was, first of all, to understand what a Jew is, we had to examine a Jew as belonging to a species. Now, normally speaking, he belongs to the species of human beings. And I explained to you last week that the scientific world divides the whole of life into three categories. They call them kingdoms, and it starts with the mineral kingdom, the vegetable kingdom, and the animal kingdom, and that's all there is. And everything must fall into one of those three kingdoms, and human beings fall into the animal kingdom. The ancient philosophers, the Greek philosophers, divided them into four kingdoms. They said, same mineral kingdom, vegetable kingdom, animal kingdom, but human kingdom, a human being, was different from all the others. So we can see that they already had quite a different attitude to life from what the scientists have today. Then comes that the Jew says that the human kingdom, the Jew calls the human kingdom the Medaber, the Suga Medaber, that is the kingdom that that has speech. And what distinguishes the human being from the animal is that he is able to speak, and how important that is. Now, the Torah comes along and says that there are really five categories. That in addition to the mineral, vegetable, animal, and human, there is the Jew. And the Jew falls into a separate category. So the Jew has got techunos. The Jew has got characteristics. He's got traits which are intrinsic in him that are not to be found in the others, in the other people. And of course, the argument that the secularists give against it, the secularists want to be the same as the Goyim. And the secularists say that Jews are just as good as Goyim or just as bad as Goyim, and some Jews even think that Goyim are better than they, and they want to forget that they are Jews and become Goyim. Now, the first thing is, we took the various things that the Goyim say about the Jews. For example, this was today one doesn't hear it as much, but one still hears it a little bit. But there was a time when the Jews were blamed for being communists. And in America, during the McCarthy era, that was heard a lot. Now, the husband and wife team that were actually put to death, what were their names?
Rosenberg.
The Rosenbergs, that was a given example, they are Jews, and they are communists. Oppenheimer, as long as he was working for the atom bomb, it was a riot. When that was over, he was accused of handing over secrets to Russia, and that he was a communist. And we don't know the whole story. it's possible that there was truth in it, and I can quite understand that there was truth in it. He wasn't the only one that was doing it. And so Jews were to be accused of being communists. When Hitler came to power, he accused Jews of being, when it suited him, of being capitalists, and when it suited him, of being communists. So Jews were accused of being capitalists, and in Russia they were accused of being capitalists, and in America they were accused of being communists. Today they're still accused of being capitalists. Now, is it true or isn't it true? And if one analyzes it, one sees that Jews were communists. When communism started, and it started over 100 years ago in Russia, 1870s it started already, Jews were in the vanguard of the movement, the socialist movement it was, and they wanted, Jews wanted, of course they were Jews who had given up Torah, and these Jews wanted to have, they were keen on internationalism, there mustn't be nations, and so they used to have meetings, and their minutes were kept in Russian. Keep them in Hebrew and Yiddish, they kept them in Russian, and it was only in the late 1800s and already at the beginning of the century where the Jewish communists became disappointed with the Russian communists, because when the Tsar, in order to put an end to the movement, ordered that all the communists were to be rounded up, which they were, and then the instructions were, each communist was to be asked, are you a communist or not? If he said yes, he was shot on the spot, rounded up and put on the marketplace. If he said no, I'm not a communist, the instructions were, let him go. Even if he said, are you a communist? And he said no, also, that's no, let him go. And the reason was that then he can't be a devoted communist. If he is not prepared to say that he is a communist. And what happened then was, the Jews were the ones who said yes, they are communists, and they were killed, and the Russians said no, and they were saved. The Jews were so disappointed that they decided to go to America. And there was a tremendous emigration of these Jews to America, and they settled in New York. And then you have these newspapers, the Forwards, Forwards means forward, and that was the slogan of the socialists and the communists, and they were anti-religious, and they settled in New York. This went on for some considerable time. And the newspaper, they had a daily newspaper, the very prominent newspaper, the Forwards, and of course it was a communist newspaper, socialist, communist, sometimes communism was a bad word, there was socialism, but that was the paper. So they were really in the vanguard of it. It was perfectly true. Karl Marx was a Jew, Engels was a Jew, Trotsky was a Jew. All these people, as soon as the head of the movement, were Jews. Now, that is, they showed tremendous mesirus nefesh. And the thesis is, and this is really the thesis of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. The thesis of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is that if one takes each one of the kingdoms, you take the mineral kingdom and the vegetable kingdom, the vegetable kingdom has got already biological life. The mineral kingdom hasn't. Now, the point is that the vegetable kingdom, it doesn't mean that it's got one advantage over the mineral kingdom. It's altogether a different type of creation. The animal hasn't got one advantage over the vegetable. The whole essence of the animal is completely different from that of the vegetable. The whole essence of the human being is completely different from that of the animal. Now, in the same way as there are Jews who can't take it that they are different from Gentiles, and they want to be the same as Gentiles, they are human beings who don't want to be different from animals, and they want to be the same as animals. And so they will say, well, there is really no difference, so the human being can speak. but it's not so. In the same way as the plant is completely different from the stone, from the mineral, it's not that it just has biological life, and as the animal is completely different from the plant, it doesn't mean that the animal has got zoological life and the plant hasn't. And as so the human being is completely different from the animal, and the Jew is completely different from the Gentile. He has got certain traits of character, and one of the great traits of his character is Mesirus Nefesh, and that is completely dedicated. Now we live here in California, and we are at the edge of the world. The world ends with California, and then it doesn't begin again until very much further east, but we're a long way from there if you want to get back to where it begins again. So we're really on the edge. We don't know very much of what goes on. We don't see it. But as I always tell you, I have seen what devotion to the Torah is, but such devotion that unfortunately one sees very little of it today. It's still there, but it's in such short supply that one doesn't really see the real devotion and dedication to the Torah, where people haven't got enough to eat, but they are happy that they are able to study the Torah. They've got no idea what dedication to the Torah. And I told you that when I was studying, I didn't know what it was to make my own bed or to prepare my own food. My landlady attended to it. And if I tried to do it, she would never allow me to do it. To her, it was to wrap a ben tola, to serve a ben tola, to her, that was the greatest honor. Didn't want to know anything else. And we didn't live in law dormitories, we lived with the family. But there was such devotion to Torah. And I was ill once, I broke my leg, but the way she looked after me. But that happened, that was the landlady. What she loved the student that was staying with her, she loved. And every landlady thought that she had the best student in the issue. But every landlady thought that. And I told you that my wife still met my landlady, and all the children still met her, and they used to go and visit her. She was a most remarkable woman. And we used to think, everyone used to think that he had the best landlady, of course. That's the way it went. But this was the devotion to the terror. He had a big terror. Such devotion to the terror. Now, that is the serious nefesh. Now, when that is a quality that the Jew has, but a Jew has it to the ultimate degree. When he doesn't give that mysterious message to the Torah, for that is what it's meant to be. Otherwise, you can't have Torah. If there isn't mysterious message, you can't have Torah. It won't be the real Torah. If the Jew hasn't got it, but he's got it in it, then his mysterious message is used for something else. It's transferred, but it has to find an outlet. So the outlet can find it in communism, can find it in capitalism, can find it in permissiveness. He takes part in everything that is going. He's right in the forefront of everything that is going. That is the mysterious selfishness that you have. Now, we're coming now to another quality that the Jew has. And please, don't forget that what is so important about Musar is that when one learns Musar, it is fatal to say, I know somebody to whom that applies. Mm-hmm. Then leave Musar alone, it's not for you. Musar is when you hear it, and you say, but that is I am that, it applies to me. That is the only way you can learn Musar. So, we show sometimes the serious message, but we show it for the wrong things. And so we discussed this already, that in the late 1950s, in the 1960s, in the permissiveness, Jews were right in the forefront of it. They led, Jews led the campaign. The three great professors, They led the campaign in Knessetness. Set the pace, and they led it. The Chiyus Nefesh gave everything for it. This is exactly how it had to be. Now, there's another quality that the Jews got. And the Gemara makes a very strange statement. The Gemara says, "Mitreimar mit no Torah Yisrael." Why was the Torah given to Israel? Bikday shehem azri ponim. Because they are, now azri ponim is a very difficult term to translate. It's usually translated because they are impertinent. It's usually translated because they are cheating. It means all that. But when a person is impertinent and he's cheeky, is he impertinent to himself and cheeky to himself, or has he got to have an audience, even if it's only an audience of one? Has to have an audience. So there's somebody else. Now, what is really Azus Kodim? Now, we get a case of Azus Kodim, and this is the Gemara gives this as the example of Azus Kodim. You remember the story of how Moshe Rabbeinu, it says, Vayigdal Moshe, and Moshe Rabbeinu was growing up, Vayetze el Erchov, Vayar the Sidler Zon. He went out to his brethren, and he saw their burdens, their suffering. And then he sees an Egyptian smiting a Jew. So he turns, he looks around, and he sees that there's nobody looking. Jews are looking, but he sees that there are no Egyptians about. So he kills the Egyptian and he hides him in the sand, he buries him quickly in the sand. And he carries on as if nothing has happened. The next day he goes out again and he sees two Jews having an argument. So he says to the one, he says to him, to the Rosho, to the one who is obviously in the wrong, he says, Lomo Sachere Echo, why are you smiting your next one? Why are you doing it? This one turns round to him and says, Me Soma Chole Ishar Vesho Feta Lady, who are you? Since when are you a prince and a judge over us? Since when is this? Now the Gemara says that is Aziz Pony. So we begin to understand what it is that is Aziz Pony. He says, who appointed you as a prince and as a judge over us? Doesn't want to accept authority. That's the first thing. No authority. Now, a Jew has got Aziz Pony. There's no question about it. And a Jew is described as Amkashay Ove. It's a stiff-necked people. Not a very nice beetle to have. Not a very nice trait to have. What is the meaning of Amkashay Ove? What does Rabbi Eliezer mean to say when he says the Torah was given to the Jews because they are Aziz Pony? Now, you can really only be a Jew if you will accept the correct authority and you've got the ability to reject any other authority. If there is any other authority, it is an authority of permissiveness. You've got to have the other's pulling to reject that. There are all kinds of things going on in the world. For example, in America, and you've heard me speak about that, each nation has got particular qualities. The English are known for their courtesy. The Germans are known for their organization. The Americans, what do Americans know? They've got a system here. They don't want anything for nothing. They pay for everything they get. And they want to get paid for everything they do. For everything they give, they want to get paid. And it's a system that works extremely well in America. It's a wonderful economy. Very bad process. Very bad terror. But from the point of view of economy, it is highly successful. work extremely well. That is the way it works. There are countries, for example, the English tradition, doctors are trained and dentists, but they do not accept payment from ministers of religion. The rabbis fell under the same category. In America, it doesn't exist, and it's quite in order. It works very well. The rabbis and ministers have got to pay for medical services or for dental services, but it works in the reverse too. If the doctor wants to consult the minister, he gets paid. But if he sends the minister, he pays for it. Now, the terrorism doesn't work that way. But that is a way in which America works. Everything goes, it works that way. The economy works that way, and it is good. Now, to be able to live in a society and not to make that your way of life. And I gave you the example once in New York where I was in a home. A little girl is there, she's going to babysit, and the father tells her, "Look, you know what it is, I don't remember the sum now. It's no longer $2.50, it's now $3, so see that you make it clear that you get $3 an hour for babysitting." So when the little girl went out, I said to the father, I said, "Does she get paid for this?" He said, "Of course. She must learn to know what money is." I said, "Then where's the chesed? Where's the chesed? How are you going to teach a little girl chesed? What is chesed?" Then he laughed at her. "It's nothing with the chesed. You give tobacco and it is saying that you've got to learn what money is." Now, it's a different culture here. It's a different society. Now, not to live like that is very difficult. Not to look like that. This is the atmosphere. This is what we find. Now, for a Jew not to give way to that, for that you need others. For that you need others. I had an occasion where our grandson was going to camp, and I wanted to have a rebbe for him an hour a day. Well, I wanted to know, but I said, "I want to know what the charge will be." I said, "No, we'll get right." I said, "No, I must know what the charge will be." Well, a couple of days later, I got phoned, and I was chilling the charge per hour, so I worked it out, and just embraced this. The woman was speaking to me, and I listened to it, and I said, "No, I'm not going to do that." I said, "Do you know, I'm taking it for a month, it's going to be there for a month. He'll get paid more, this is a young yeshiva man that's teaching him. He'll get more, he'll get a big, for 1 month he'll get paid more than I get paid. Just for 1 month of teaching, what kind of a thing is this?" This is a yeshiva man. But that is America, he's under this whole influence of America. To be able not to do that sort of thing, you've got to have others. You've got to have others. To be able to reject that and not to do that, you've got to have others. So, what happens if a person hasn't got the others for Torah, doesn't use it for Torah? He'll use it for other things. So he will use it to reject Torah. He will use it to show his rejection of Torah. And we find this happening over and over again. There's a very interesting midrash. The midrash says as follows, that when Moshe heard these words that this Jew said to him, that he said, "Why are you smiting your brother?" And he said, "Me so macholo each side that shall take to a ladle. Who put you over us? Who did that?" And Moshe Rabbeinu said that now I know why Jews are suffering in Egypt. Didn't know why? Now I understand why they're suffering in Egypt. So my uncle explained what it means. He said it doesn't mean now he knows that they are suffering and no other nation is suffering. It doesn't mean that the Jews are worse and that's why they're suffering. They have to suffer. That's not the reason. But what Moshe Rabbeinu says is something very simple. He says, now I know why the Jews are here. Because they have got this characteristic, they've got this trait of Aziz Poni. They cannot accept authority. Now, if they cannot accept authority, then they dare not be free. If they are free, they just go wild. Either they've got to have the authority of the Torah, and if they haven't got the authority of the Torah, then they've got to be embodied. So it's got to be under some authority, but it has to be perforce there. Either they accept the authority of the Torah, or they've got to be under some, they can't be free. And that is why immediately the B'nai Yisrael leave Egypt, immediately leave Egypt, straight away to the Torah. And they count the days till the Torah is given. One day has gone past, the second day, till the 49 days have gone past. They count each day because they know that their fulfillment comes only with the Torah. Away from the bondage of Egypt and into the service of Hashem. And they accept the authority of the Torah. They don't accept the authority of the Torah, they will accept other authorities, but it will be the wrong authority. And that is how currently you see that. And so of course they are, I'm to say earlier, they are a stiff-necked people. They've got to be that in order to carry out the Torah, to live in America and carry out the Torah. You know how difficult it is. Today it's easier. But I tell you, just to read Nechama's book, Nechama Shein's book, all through the bus. And we spoke to her, and I wanted to know all about it. And she told us how when her father came, he was a boy. He had, in 1 year, he had 52 jobs. Because every Monday morning, they fired him. You didn't come in on Shabbos? Fired. 54 jobs, 52 jobs in 1 year he had. Didn't get any job. Yeah. And then, not to give in, don't work on Shabbos. Of course you've got to have. You've got to be an amkashe odor. Of course you've got to have it. But it's for the right thing. And if you haven't got it for the right thing, you'll have it for the wrong thing. You'll still be tiffed, but then you'll be stubborn. But it'll be for the wrong thing and not for the right thing. So, we've got to realize that we are in a dangerous position also. We've got wonderful qualities, and it's very easy to transfer those qualities and misuse them and abuse those qualities. Now, there we've got already, we're dealing with two of the qualities that the Jew has got, and how, if he doesn't use them for the right place, they are transferred. Those qualities are transferred and he uses them in the wrong place. Now you know, Sima, you wanted to ask something.
There's a question of the observation that
yes.
South America is so dangerous to the Jews because they did not accept the Jewish Torah. There is no other Torah.
Yes, it's come to that. You see that now it's come. That is also rejection of authority. There is no authority, you see. But you can do that very easily. Yes, there is.
So I've talked about those qualities, but there is more
explicit to the Jews,
is it?
To that extent it is. I mean, you know, Moshe Rabbeinu speaks about the Am Yisrael, and Hashem says they are amkashe olif, they are stiff-necked people. Doesn't say it about anybody else.
I'm just a teacher of children.
Yes, but have they got it to the same extent? The Jews have got it to a tremendous extent. You know the old story when Roosevelt spoke to Weizmann and he said how difficult it is to be president in a country there are, I think there's about 150 million people. Mm-hmm. You've got to deal with 150 million people. The Reichsman says, oh, he says, you don't know what difficulty is. You've got to deal with a country where there are 1 million presidents. So that is the difference, you see. Now you can do it. He's also got his scientists. It's very difficult. But that is a property that all these properties are properties that are meant for a Jew to be able to be himself and to fulfill himself. And if he doesn't, then it is transferred into another area. And now we believe that every trait that a person has is a good trait. It can be misused and it can be abused, but that is what the person does with it. So if you can mention, there are only two exceptions that the Gemara makes, but there's a reason for that. But anything else that a person has, any other trait that a person has, it must be a good trait. Otherwise, God wouldn't have created in the person. And that is why the Rambam says, and I've mentioned this to you before, there is no word in Hebrew, in Rosh HaKodesh, for virtue or vice. The word is midor. Midor means a measurement. And it's either midor tovo or midor ro. It's either good measurement or bad measurement. If you've got it in the right amount, it's a good measurement. If you've got it in the wrong amount, too much of it or too little of it, then it's a bad measurement, and then it becomes a midor ro. But there's no such thing as a bad midor, and we don't want anybody to root out a particular characteristic or trait that he's got. That we don't want. We want him to control it, we want him to discipline it, we want him to be master over it, we want him to be complete master over it, but we want him to have it. Doesn't matter what it is. Yeah, the two worst characteristics that a human being can have, the one is anger, and the other is guile, is arrogance. But we don't want the person to root out our anger. We want him to be completely in control over it, not to root it out. When there are those who undermine the terror, they're David HaMelech says, the Tachlit Tivos HaMesi. I hated them with the utmost hatred. There we find that he has anger, and there we find that he has hatred. So it must be able to be used at the right time, in the right place, for the right thing. But not to uproot it, that we don't want. We want a person to channel it by all means, channeling, not to uproot it. Because it's impossible to uproot it. And if you try to uproot it, it's going to burst out in the wrong place, at the wrong time, with the wrong thing. So it goes right through. Now, the final a matter that we find with the Jew, we find very much with the Jew, is this is love of money. Now, we have to confess that it's right. Jews do love money. Not only in America, although in America it's more pronounced than anywhere else, but Jews love money. And they do sometimes, they do bad things for money. I have other cases. Love of money. Now, the Jews are Ahavas Torah, the love for the Torah. If the Jew hasn't got an inordinate love for Torah, he'll never be able to carry it out. Never be able to study it and never be able to carry it out. Got to have an inordinate love for Torah. If he hasn't got the love for Torah, then he's got it for other things. Now, it's very interesting. The Torah is one of those things, she'en lohem shiur. It's got no end. The Torah itself, aruka ve'eretz mido rechove miniyom. It is, the length of it is longer than the ends of the earth. And the width of it is wider than the width of the sea. There is no end to the Torah.
love for the person of terror must be an insatiable love for the terrorist. Only then can it really work. Now, well, nothing becomes despondent that we haven't got that love for the terror. We try and have a little bit of it. And however little we get of it, that we've got something of it, it means something. That is already a lot. An insatiable love. You know that a person can be satisfied with everything. My wife gives me a meal and says, would you like a second helping? I said, no, thank you. My wife says, why not? Don't you enjoy it? I said, I enjoy this tremendously. It was wonderful. But I'm satisfied. I can't have any more. Have enough. To everything, you have enough. You don't want any more. Work is not right. No, that you don't find. Man has got enough. And the person who's got 100 wants 200. That is the way it is. The Tao explains. If a person has got 100, he wants 200. Insatiable. Because it is exactly that same love that he's transferred. That same love that he's got in it, which is meant for the Torah. If he doesn't use for the Torah, it's transferred. Now it's used for something else. Now, I've told you all this, and my uncle used to speak a lot about it, and he spent a lot of time with us at various stages explaining this and explaining what Rabbi Yehuda Levi said. And I wanted to hear this because this is helps you so much to understand the world around about us. Something you understand. Now, I want to explain also to you something that has happened in the world. And I've spoken to you about it at various times. You know, people misinterpret things, and it can go on a long time and can cause a lot of damage. Paul Johnson, in one of his books, and it's worthwhile reading Paul Johnson because he is one of the few people today who are really thinkers. Today they are journalists, but he is really a thinker. Now, and in one of his books he writes called The Modern Age. And he speaks about relativity, and he said it started somewhere by 1990. He calls it a new era started then, and he speaks about that Einstein gave a lecture on relativity. And then the world was mad about relativity. How many people understood relativity in those days? You could count them on the fingers of your one hand. Very few people understood relativity. But this became a term. So he spoke about the relativity in science and in physics. What did the world do? It immediately spoke of anything is relative. Once anything is relative, there's nothing absolute. And this suited the world very, very well. Because this was part of an influence in the world that started 250 years ago. And the influence was to throw off authority. And that was the beginning of an age, to reject all authority. Now, even there, they rejected authority, and authority went to other places. That was the result of French Revolution. No authority, French Revolution was one of the results of it. A young woman mentioned to me, and she was absolutely right, and said, wasn't that the beginning of reform? Exactly. Reform 1790, there was reform already. Rejecting of the authority of the Torah was able to be done. And that is something that has been done extremely successfully. This rejection of all authority has been done insidiously that it, and it's been done gradually but very successfully. And it expresses itself today in various forms. We've already spoken about divisiveness, no authority. Don't listen to parents, don't listen to teachers. You're your own master, no authority. Now, it goes in all areas, and another expression of it is, he says, that Hashem instilled or created in nature a power that stands and watches over everything, and it will not be removed from its charge, but it must carry on in that way in which it's been created. For example, there is sun for illness. There is a star over the trees. That is that there is a power over trees. The Shabbat is almost the half of it in itself. And this power sees that trees grow. That is what the star does. The Ula be against that Zayda Mirafim of Izzara Shemal, Yechazik Saro Ruach, Yechazik Saro Ruach, could be mighty good at all. But it is possible that Hashem can decree to the sun of the wind, because of the wind is also a sun, can decree over the sun, or over the sun of the wind, that it must uproot the trees. And so the power over the trees must give way for the power of the wind. But these are powers that exist, and these powers are the roots of everything that has been created. The Yiddokh Hussain Yilonis Kepizeh, the Yiddokh Kepizeh Yilonis Kepizeh, and through the power of the wind, which is stronger than the power of the trees can be uprooted. The Yiddokh be the very more early Hadrogo Rabbis Prophet. And there are many degrees, and there are many details with regard to this. Creation Elohim Pekidei Adei Va'agashmin Amakvikim Kor Cheto Agashmin B'chim Yisim Adrivi. Because there are these forces that are put over the physical world, and they maintain and sustain all the physical world by certain physical and natural laws, the Alayim Sorei Gezeireis Agamim Amenim Malachei Atera, and over them, over these powers, there are other powers. For example, the powers of reward, who can remove the powers of nature, which are both within the Fiat Gezeireis, and can circumvent matters according to the decrees of the Almighty. The Ham of Protila Protila, the Ham of Leir, Sufre, Halogos, and Postumas. And of course, there are many wondrous things that it is much too much for us to understand arising from all this. But what the essence of what we have learned is that everything that there is in the universe is just a source. And at this point there is this power, and it is this power that controls it. Now the only thing is how to understand what the Medora Hashem is saying. Does he say that a material thing is created, let us say the trees are created, but at their source they are atoms and consisting of energy at its very source. Now, does the Bore of Hashem say, and over that there is a sun, or do we say no, that at the source that is the sun? Am I making myself clear? I'm not making myself clear. Let me try again. What is it
it's so far that the other has been a thing, that over everything that they eat in the universe, they eat a malach or a sar or a fat.
You can take anything. I've already given you the example of water.
So is that water. Below that, it's a liquid. Below that, it becomes a gas. It is hydrogen and oxygen. Below that, this gas is divided further, and now it becomes atoms. Below that, getting down now to the source, these atoms, what are these atoms? Electrons. And there's a nucleus. So the electrons are pure energy. We go lower, the nucleus, you break down the nucleus, you find that you break down the nucleus, you've got particles. You break down the particles, again you've got energy. You come right down to the bottom and you've got energy. So that is really the source of what is at the top, that is the water. So you can turn it down, it doesn't matter. You can say the bottom is the water and the top is easy, the energy, it doesn't matter. Now, the Derech Hashem says there is a power that controls all that. What I want to know is, when we reach rock bottom, or at the top it makes no difference, is that the power, is there where the power is, it's all energy, and that is the power, or is the power something separate, that is, it's another power that is placed in charge. Now, do you follow? Is that so that can clear that? Now, what I'm taking the view that at the very bottom, or at the very top of everything is, there is the power itself, and that is the source. And when the Rambam speaks that they understand that that is the source, that is the power that has got it. But as it goes on, there's nothing at all. Yes?
I'm understanding what you're saying, yes. But I'm needing a little clarification. If it's true that it's at the source, that the source itself is the procedure of God,
yes.
Then every object has its own specific self.
When you say object,
well, one body of water has one, and one body of water will have another.
No, it's water. It's not each body of water. It's just water. It's just water. That is its origin.
Because the energy that
is for whatever volume it is, that is only one. That's all it is.
Okay.
Following, for a human being it's different. It's for each human being. Is that clear?
Yeah.
We're going to have more of it. Derech Hashem is going to speak. The trees, there's just one power that is over all trees. That is the way he's going to explain it. There's another view also, but that is the way he explains it. See that?
So then that's what the question is pertinent to what you're doing.
Yes.
If the order of creation, the order in which Hashem created everything in the world, is that indicative perhaps of the gratitude that that thing has to understand, to see that he went with the love of animals, but no greater than manners, to understand. And the existence of the celestial beings, the stars, and
they've got that understanding, but in their source, you see, in the source, the moon itself, you see the moon itself. Mm-hmm. That's not, but in its source, there it is. There it's got the feet.
Is the order of creation in any way
accessible today? You know, the order of creation is really what happens. Everything, when it says these things were created in the book of the various days, they were created, but they were not activated. They were activated only on the sixth day. It's then Hashi Shi by a Kulas Mai. On the sixth day, and the end of the earth, the then finished. They were activated only on the sixth day.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Mm-hmm. See, that is the view, that is the view of out. When the Rashi comes out very full,
biography of a great man, and as you read, he becomes smaller and smaller.
by the time you get three quarters through the book, he is 2.5 millimeters high. And the person who reads it gets so much satisfaction because now he's the same height. He's also only 2.5 millimeters high. Because anything is to reduce it, you see. Reduce it. There is no mythology. There's nobody better than anybody else. Everybody is the same. So you get all these biographies that he's written down. They will destroy a person. Nobody is better than anybody else. You know, I didn't realize what a president of the United States has got against you. I say to myself, I wouldn't be president of the United States for all the oil in Saudi Arabia and all the oil taken out of the wells and packed in barrels ready to be sold, and it's mine. I wouldn't be the president of the United States. I only found out a few years ago that he's got to account for every, when he came into the office, it's all written down. If he was 5 minutes late when he came into the Oval Office, everything is written down. He's got to account for everything. He's got his, he's responsible to Congress. Congress is responsible to the people. Where is the authority? It's all, the authority has gradually been diminished all the time. Now, I must say that it isn't altogether bad, because authority has also been misused. It has become, it became tyranny, and when it becomes tyranny, there's no room for it. That's bad. And I suppose that that had a lot to do with it, because of the tyranny, there was the throwing over of authority. But the people, it always comes out in some way or other. They reject authority, of one type of authority, then they will subject themselves to another authority. And we have the best example of that was in Hitler Germany. Now, after the First World War, there was a lack of authority. They threw off authority. They threw off the Kaiser. There wasn't the authority there. There were several governments, one government after another. And then when Hitler came, the people were ready to accept authority. Yeah, it's the authority that they accept. Now, some nations are more prone to it than others. Germans like having authority. They want authority. Other nations don't. England doesn't. An Englishman doesn't want that type of authority. He doesn't like it. Likes a certain amount of authority. But so it is with the Jew especially. He's got these traits. Now, if anybody up on the aisle wants to ask me any questions, this. I just want to very briefly tonight deal with a certain passage in the Derech Hashem with which we are dealt. And it's a passage that disturbed me because I just couldn't get it all together right. This is on page 170 and 171. It's the end of the second part and we've completed it already. But there's just something that I didn't get, I couldn't get right at the time, and since then I've been able to work it out. I'm not going to read it in size and translate it. It's paragraph 4 or Dalit. But I just want to give you the contents of it. What he says is that there is a certain rule in the world situation from the time it was created. And it is that there are four levels through which the progress of the world passes. Now, when I learned it the first time,
I couldn't get it right because I took it to be that the world passes through four periods. And I learned it when he said the first period is the first 2,000 years. And the second period, I took it to be the next 2,000 years. But then when I went over it and over it very many times, I began to understand it, and I want to explain to you now exactly what he says. He says, Kishanea, and Abidya Klaun Matsveya Orum, May Ozi Borei Kepiya Nikri Shekoru Behu. He says, Nimtso Badover Arba Hadrogas. We find that the world is four stages, and now an interesting thing. The Nekshav Haminu Enoshi Kulika Odom Echos Ma'esi Voda Ad Omda Apirka Kerei. He says you can compare the stages of the world, the development of the world, to the development of a human being. So what are the first years of a human being? It's darkness. Now, we haven't got it like that. This is what worries me. We know that in Odom Orisha there was greatness in Odom Orisha. Afterward the darkness came. But what he's saying is something quite different. He says that the history is divided into segments, and each segment starts off with a period of darkness, like with the birth of a child. The next segment is already the segment when enlightenment comes, absolutely all right. The third segment is even greater. But you won't understand it if you only learn it like that. Now just let us look at the next paragraph, the last paragraph of the Kaiva. You may mean so matzom echot, and we find that there is one matzom. He doesn't say that he may mean so matzom rishon. He doesn't say the first state. He says one state is where there is foolishness and darkness with the child, a babe. It's foolish and darkness. It's not the first state, but it is one state. And that is a segment. He says the next stage is a matzah of a shade who must have told me that it's better, and that is when there is knowledge of Hashem. Knowledge of Hashem is already there, and knowledge of the Torah. Then he says the third stage is where it is this prophecy, like we had the third stage in the time of the Levim, when there was prophecy before the destruction of the first place of Migdosh. And the last stage is when there is no foolishness anymore, no folly anymore, there's prophecy, there's Torah, that is the fourth stage. But what he is saying is that these are segments, and it doesn't mean to say that the segment is going to go the whole course. The segment can be broken off. So you can have a segment that starts in darkness, and it can come to enlightenment, but it doesn't go to the third stage, and then it's broken off. Now we are in the stage today, we were before the war, we reached to the second stage, where there was a stage of great enlightenment. Now immediately after the period of the Rishonim, that is round about the year 1500, Jews went through a terribly, terribly hard time. It was the end of the Crusades, they'd lost a lot of whole villages. What is his name who wrote those volumes of history?
Durant.
Durant says in his notes that it's recorded that 500 Jewish villages were wiped out. Mm-hmm. 500 just wiped out along the Rhine. So you can imagine what they went through. Then there were the pogroms in Russia, the Khmelnytsky pogroms. There aren't the records for that. But there again, whole villages of Jews were just wiped out during those pogroms. It was a dark period that we entered. It didn't take long, and the Torah in Galicia especially, there was a Torah started being studied, we had great men, great works were made, and it came a period of enlightenment. Then comes the destruction, the wars, the destruction. Go in after the war into a period of darkness again. And that is the period in which we find ourselves today. And it's one that affects not us, it affects the whole world. It affects the secular world, it affects the Gentile world. But we are in a period of darkness, and that we have to know. And we do the very best we can to get into the next period. And the next period is only, it's a period of enlightenment. And as I've told you, I already see the beginnings of the next period. So slowly, then slowly. But it is the beginnings of the next period. So, no disappointments and no heartaches. We go steadily on. Of course, there are setbacks. Occasionally, there are setbacks. It's a terrible period through which we're living, period of terrorism. And if you are so young that this is the only period you know. But when I was studying in London, to go back on your own, by yourself, in the early hours of the morning, you wouldn't think twice about it. Nobody worried about it. When we were in London, my wife was out late with some friends of hers, and she came back. I didn't worry if she came back 2 o'clock in the morning, 1 o'clock in the morning, in the summer months. The Shabbos used to be out late. 1 o'clock in the morning, knew everything. Today, I wouldn't allow to cross the street by myself once it's dark. Can't do it anymore. It's a dark age in which we are living. And that we've got in there. And we make our own small contribution to it. That is our purpose. Thank you, ladies. Any questions? Yes, Simon.
Thank you. How can we expect to get out of the dark period? How do
they change for the better? The various things happen in the world. Now, the interesting thing is, as far as the Jews are concerned, there has never been a period where we were left completely without anything. The stock has always made. Something always made. And you've heard me speak that one of the miracles that I find is how with the destruction came and all was destroyed in Europe, all the places of learning were destroyed. When all that happened and the war was over, we find that in every sphere of Jewish Torah activity, one great man was left over. In every sphere. There wasn't a sphere that was left absolutely desolate. There wasn't a great school that there wasn't one that was a representative. And that person put his all into it. Just to sow a seed that it should be and successfully. And wherever you go, you had Moshe Feinstein in America, what he did to save the Torah. And a person like Yaakov Kalinetsky, what he did to save the Torah. You had Rebbe Kotler, you had Rebbe Mordechai Katz. You had 3-5 giants there. Each one was great in a specific field. Save Torah for America. And so we find these were people. But the television was good. And I treasure those moments he spent with me and told me exactly what happened. He got the news that his wife had been killed, his children had been killed, his daughter killed, his grandchildren were killed, son-in-law killed, whole yeshiva killed, nothing left. And he asked himself, why have I been saved? There must be something that I've got to a greater extent than anybody else. Because that is, I know what that is. I can create centers of Torah, center of Torah, I can create it. Now I've just got to decide where. He decided in Israel. But look what he built out there. He was knew that he was there. And each one of these great men knew that they were left for that particular purpose. Built out. Absolute miracle. Those are things that change. And as they talk in very, very often, so we go through the stages. The first stage is the stage of darkness. The next stage will be a stage of enlightenment. We hope that the third stage will be a stage of each prophecy. The fourth stage, that is the final stage. It's interesting. If you take the Agoda, there are four sons. The wise, the wicked, the simple, and the doesn't have to ask a question. Put them in the reverse, and you've got the human being. Doesn't have to ask a question. Simple, a child, nothing. A babe, nothing. The next stage is simple. You can begin teaching, and you're feeling, you're teaching. The third stage, the teenagers. Got to deal with the teenagers. That's your third stage, you see. And the fourth stage, you see, that's the chokhmah. The very reason you can already be. So those are the four stages. And everything seems to work in four stages. You want to create something, first stage you are ignored. Second stage you are ridiculed. Third stage you are fought. Fourth stage you are accepted. Everything four stages. You come into our community, four stages. First stage you settle in. Second stage you settle down. Third stage you adjust. Fourth stage you integrate. Always works in four stages. Now I don't know whether this is by accident or whether it is by design. Whatever the case, that is our observation of it. Thank you, ladies.
Some say that it was a male. Some say that it was a male-female. It was an androgynous human being having characteristics of both. That's really a moot question. The question is simply because the movie of a woman having a man. I mean, if you don't have that position of two sexes, all that is specifically critical is that why did we have to have two genders? Huh? It's a very different question. Well, told her also the Levada. What good man to be that? Why not? And magic goes into the very same. This goes not practical. It's a young man. A human being who thinks that he is all by himself, he doesn't need anyone else, that he is totally self-sufficient, it's a very dangerous human being. And Rashi here tells us the God that is going to be the God by himself, all by myself. I can take care of myself totally. I will be in the Everyone has to know that he's in complete time and he needs completion to another man, to another man. It is not, no one can achieve goodness, ethical completion by himself. And that's the reason we are created in that way. You know, but we are incomplete in and of ourselves. We need completion by living and waiting in the moment. That is the reason that is the creation of woman. The creation of woman. The creation of the human being in this way. To create one person and separate one being and separate that being as a human being, so you only complete each of that.
Very strange. also beings, earthly beings there, nature beings, again, this is part of it. And I cannot imagine that the creator will create the world and put it in all three, the people of this particular earth, as part of our beings, the magic, and other,
that is obviously a serious question. There are two different approaches, I believe, in resolving. There is the approach that the complainant mentioned about covenant, about who is the object. And God created the world. He created the world. Then he goes to explain why he feels that reason. All due respect to Lubavitcher, that was my fine gentleman. I find that a little passive on my my imagination. I would be hard pressed to say rationally why, except my gut, my gut feeling that the goes against it. Although, I am likewise very skeptical about scientific data, when in my position I'm told that there are two discontinuities. There is one discontinuity with the time of blood, that troubles me very much about daily beyond. I am likewise doubly troubled from a scientific anthropological is that we have no continual records of human civilization that go back that far. If conscious, intelligent human beings existed in southern France 20,000 years ago, why is it that we have no records of human civilization that go far, that far? We have about 6,000, which are still enough within the ballpark that I can live comfortably. But if I am a total doubter of that, I would like to know, and I assume for argument's sake that there were no creatures, and that there were conscious, intelligent human beings 20,000 years ago. Why is it that we have no records of civilization and continual records of continuous civilization that go back down? That I find to be a very distressing problem, which even from a non-religious scientific point of view, would cause me to question whatever methods I have of dating those kids in front of them. So either I think it was independently of that continual human record of civilization. Let me have continual human record of civilization going down. But I think it's not particularly overly impressed with dating techniques. But beyond that, I even simply wonder why you have no record of civilization. Assuming that human beings, intelligent beings, inhabited this planet 20,000 years ago, assuming that, I find it very strange that we find records of culture that go back to 20,000 years ago. We can find no continual records that extend anywhere remotely near that. Which I think is a call to the question. That data technique, yes, the data technique used to come up with that.
Which suggests that those entrances could not exist.
Records go back as far as there is language to express records. And Okay, then let's look at the Evan. Look at Crane of Evan. Okay. Then, the father's going to say that it seems very strange to me that there should be a spontaneous formation plan in many places, and that he should be involved. Are you saying that it's very hard to believe that they would then evolve, let's say, down the same train?
Yeah, rather than being ending up with such physically similar ethics and psychologically, so similar in many ways, so similar in different.
I don't even find that hard to believe at all. So in the sense that all the development, this is the reaction to their physical environment. If the physical environment are similar enough to produce similar reactions, they are going to have cultural similarities. In other words, man invented the wheel not because that's right. And let's put it this way, everywhere around the world, man has made a wheel. I mean, but this wheel is
No. Let's back up. So the difference between what intelligence means mean is a certain assessment of the response and some natural development on a physical level, and to, for instance, supposedly, let's take the origin of the giraffe. And supposedly, you know, certain kinds of animals survive better in certain environments, and also the little longer necks survive, and they're bred together, and they do something, you know, for the longer necks, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that's the supposed origin of the giraffe. The giraffe thereby only emerges the way he does, in response to certain very localized conditions. And the entire evolutionary picture in a certain specific, if you go with Darwinian rather than more Lamarckian type of development, that there's a certain survival of the fittest, even as certain quality, and sometimes it's a genetic jump just by accident. But if you're going with a Darwinian theory, so that genetic jump has to come through some sort of spontaneous mutation. Now, what you will require, therefore, is, let's say you would have giraffes emerging in North America and in Africa, you would require two things that, in order for such a thing to occur. Not only that same conditions that would enable animals along the neck to survive be present in both cases, but that same genetic jump that comes from a spontaneous, occasional, random genetic mutation, that has to occur in both places. You require both of, which is why you don't find giraffe. And if one would find giraffe, the conclusion that one always draws in the evolution structure of that is they must have originated at one point. Because what, see, there are two, when you're talking about the invention of the wheel, you say there's a certain necessity. That necessity can be universal because you do not require some random occurrence. You just require necessity being the mother of invention. We have to see, we respond by the wheel. And that's all, and that's there's a natural transition. What does not happen in any of this is the moment you work with Darwin rather than a Lamarckian thing, you require that spontaneous random jump of genetic change. And that's why within that sequence of events, why I try to say that same random occurrence happens in a whole variety of places. Random things don't work. But then you again tying back to grandchildren of that one genetic jump. If you don't tie it back to grandchildren of that one genetic jump, you have occurring this random jump in the same way all over the place, which I find simply in the way random prostitutes work, very unbelievable. I mean, that's my problem.
Not all trans things for them, many of them are also
here. I mean, that's
you're finding out more and more that trans are not still them.
Okay, that then just causes us to rethink that for many reasons. One causes us to rethink many illegal hypotheses about the whole theory of. Of evolution. I understand, but now with this rethinking, we then have to say it's not genetic, how does it work, and how did that genetic thing, does that have to be random, not random? But given the current state of the art, at least I understand that. Of that major jump that went from animal to human being, if one assumes it went that way, one certainly would have to make a number of random jumps along the way. Even if I understand the current state of the art, understanding that, I can only see that if I go to the state of the manner of the origin of man, that it should come back to myself. And it's not that maybe my own understanding of genetic change is a little limited, but if it's such a major change can occur by spontaneous, by response to environment, etc., we should see many more things occurring around us.
So this is
going to be
that's
the transmission of acquired characteristics, which is a very dangerous thing.
No, the theory is supposedly the model of the evolutionary process, namely those butterflies and heads survive because now they emerge in the same because also probably the fossil suit and therefore the birds can't find them anymore, they didn't survive. But the white one stood out
you can say one of two things. You can say that there's no such thing as by a character. Or you can say on survival, the theory you just presented is very good in saying yes. Yeah. There were thousands of butterflies. There were two, some male and female, one who happened to have a spot. And their grandchildren were more adapted to survival than the others. And, that's all that's saying, which is going back to, what? Yeah, which is no big, no big discovery.
I understood part of the 20,000 or 20,000 I can't show for only one answer, which is the middle of the answer, but it's not
the other answer is there may be some serious problems in the dating part. That I'm not, and I, to say that the august holiness of the whole dating process, especially when there are good reasons to assume that there's certain discontinuity in the whole thing, is I don't think we have to treat the whole dating process with such an august holiness. Now, just as a corollary thing, I guess that, and if one does treat the dating process with the August holiness, I think we have the question of why are there no continuing records of human civilizations that go back when?
particular area that finds houses built in
I guess it's completely wrecked in civilization. For some reason, there are no continuing records of civilization. That's not a continuing record of civilization independent of one of the artificial data. It's not. That's probably the same data process as the data paintings in the case. I mean, so, you know.